as most of you know, this is a seminar, so just speak up if you got questions. I will go through the book and try to point out what I think are the most important passages. And sometimes you'll say, okay, that's clear, let's move on. And sometimes you want to talk about it. Sometimes I'll try to bring examples. And then we go to pace of the group, and you have to give me feedback whether you think we're going too slow or too fast or how it all feels to you. Well, I thought we'd start with a foreword. A couple of points, though. The word projection, it's I have four lines down. I thought, let's take a minute, and before we plow through the book where she defines projection, let's talk about what projection is to get started. And she gives basically two definitions in the book. They're complementary. The first definition is probably the most common sense definition, and that's on page 3. The first, second, third paragraph. Jung defined projection as an unconscious, that is, unperceived and unintentional transfer of subjective psychic elements onto an outer object. That's probably not too hard to grasp. I don't realize I'm aggressive. I say that you're aggressive. So I see my psyche in you. And it's one content thrown out onto somebody else. Now that's the common sense. There is another really interesting way he defines it, and it's where he begins to separate from Freud. And that is spread out throughout the book. I think the first place she mentions it is on page 7. I don't know where I read it, but I'll give you the definition that I read, which kind of sums up what she's going to say in several places. See where the first line of the quote, Jung calls this the archaic identity of subject and object. The definition I heard, which I think is the most clear, is a projection is a disturbance in the archaic identity of subject and object. How is that different from the first definition? Well, as far as Jung's concerned, a good part of our projections aren't something that we have inside us that we put outside us. They've always been outside us. So for Freud, you have a certain part of yourself which you have introjected from your childhood, a bad parent or something like that. And then you project that out into somebody else. You're always not disagreeing with that, but he's saying also there are situations where we see part of ourselves outside of ourselves, but that part has never been inside of ourselves. So the word that's so relevant is, I don't care for the word, let's say so-called primitive psychology. They give the example of the Nigerian guy who heard the trees speaking to him. I remember once meeting a Native American bona fide shaman they brought in Missouri. And he said he'd get up in the morning and the birds talked to him. I mean, they really talked to him in his mind. I would say, no, you projected that outward. Jung would say that relationship to the what is perceived as the liveliness in the outer world has never been conscious in that primal mind. So what we're looking at is a basic, you could say the basic nature of humanity is to project. And then slowly we withdraw them, but we don't put them out and withdraw them. They're out there to begin with. Certain ones anyway. And so that's the word archaic. The identity of subject and object is that here it's very close to that original definition that you are the same as the thing you see outside. However, beware that these definitions do break down, and we'll talk about all the places they break down. But that's one of the reasons she wrote the book. They sound nice and neat, but there is a lot more to it. In other words, I don't think all voices from nature are imaginary. Lawrence Vanderpost tells a story where they were, he's the guy who discovered the Kalahari Bushmen, and they took a trek into the Kalahari Desert to find the remnants of these Stone Age peoples. And they were driving through a particular territory, and their guide said, "Do not kill any animals in this area. This is under the protection of very vengeful spirits." And we would say, "Ha, ha, ha." Sure enough, one of the guys in the group went hunting and killed a gazelle or something like that. He said, from that moment on, everything fell apart, and they almost died of starvation and dehydration. There, the carburetor broke down in their Jeep. The gas tank sprung a leak. They got a flat tire. One of the guys got sick. So it's the question, are these things always imaginary, or is there some spirit in the outer world? We'll just have to keep these questions open. So that's they're the two definitions. And if you're interested, she follows up on page 9 with this idea of disturbance. We'll talk about that. Oh, yeah, that was the other word. Disturbance, meaning even though we could say it's a projection, if it isn't bothering you, then it isn't a projection practically. The bottom line there is, if somebody is happy in their projections, leave them alone. We do this all the time in psychology. Oh, you're projecting. Well, if it's not bothering them, for Jung, then it's not a projection until it is disturbing their adaptation. And that's more of a practical point than a theoretical point, so that we learn to keep our mouths shut around people's unconsciousness until it becomes obtrusive. Those who get a little bit of psychology tend to go around and point out other people's projections quite frequently. And he's saying, don't do it until the person says, I'm in this bad relationship, how did I get there, and so on. So that's the first thing I wanted to look at, the word projection. You okay with everybody? Okay with that? With two ways of defining it. The first one is not hard. The second one is a little harder to grasp, and we'll be returning to that throughout the whole book. I just wanted to give you definitions before we got rolling. Now, those two simple little things already you can hopefully see lead into complicated territory when you hear a story like Vanderpost's. I, for example, don't think the birds were speaking to that Native American guy. I'm a little harder pressed to say it was all imagination when 10 things went wrong after the guy killed the gazelle and they almost died of starvation and dehydration. I think just miraculously somehow they were able to get the Jeep going and return to the base. So she then says, the word projection does describe a set of facts that in practice are easily enough demonstrated. Where somebody, the forward, 5 lines down. She says the word projection does, to be sure, you see where I am, everybody? So I just spent a little time giving you a preview of the definition of projection. And And then she says, does, to be sure, describe a set of facts that are in practice, that in practice are easily enough demonstrated. That's when you hear one person accusing another person of qualities you know the first person possesses in their own personality, but denies. Now, but at the same time, this concept leads into borderline areas where there are still unsolved problems, like are all spirits and the outer world merely projections? She'll be looking at the role of projection in science. She'll be looking at the role of projection in theology, taking this very simple idea and looking how, once we understand it, it rather complicates everything. So that's why she says unsolved problems. So a lot of the book, after we get through the first chapter will be just definitions and introductory comments. We'll be looking at how this concept of projection really forces us to reevaluate just about everything. And also to reevaluate what the concept of projection is. So that's the meat of the book for all the chapters, the borderline areas. A little farther down, a study of these problems brings us up against a mysterious quality of human consciousness, that of mirroring the world. What we'll get into at the end of the, toward the end of the book, is what is consciousness that we can see what a projection is, and why do we have so much difficulty seeing what our projections are. So we talk about projection for quite a bit of the book, and then at the end of the book we start talking about what's it mean to withdraw projections, what's it mean to become conscious of them. So that's why she uses the word mirroring. So we'll start off with it with one chapter defining projection, many chapters on the complications of what the concept of projection introduces into science, into religion, how those other domains force us to reevaluate our understanding of projection, and then at the end of the book we talk about what it means to withdraw them and what is consciousness that it can see.
How does this mirroring relate to children?
In that, you are the child's consciousness. And what you're doing is giving the child a model for developing its own ability to reflect. Another way to talk about mirroring is reflection.
Are we going to be thinking about what we're projection and mirroring means in terms of mirror neurons?
Well, if you're here, we probably will. Yeah, we can. Sure, we can do anything. I wasn't planning to, but that will be your area to enlighten us.
Okay, well, it just throws another light on projection. So I'll look into that.
Yeah, do look into that. Anything's game. Yeah. And, of course, we'll get into synchronicity, because the synchronicity is a mirroring. And yet, is it a projection? So she's just raising all sorts of questions around this topic.
It does raise the topic, too, of where is the psyche?
And where is the psyche?
If some of these already exist outside of us, that speaks to that question, which leads to the synchronicity issue.
Yeah, I remember I was in the Peace Corps, I may have mentioned this, when I had some friends, we go for walks at night, and we'd walk past some old temples, and I mean, it would strike terror in them. Do not go over to that corner of the temple, that's where the spirits live. So you can see how alive this was, and what Jung is saying, you know, those spirits were never inside those people. And then they expel them in a repressive defense. They've always been outside. And again, I doubt whether, had I walked over there, any harm would have come, but I didn't try. Anyway.
Could we could we relate that to, you know, just our study of Nietzsche and Zarathustra? Was Zarathustra always outside, but Nietzsche interjected, took him into himself?
Or tried to. Because we're going to talk about what does it mean to withdraw a projection. Do you withdraw it into the ego, or do you withdraw it into the self? And if you withdraw something like Zarathustra into the ego, that's when you get inflated. Exactly. And so she's, you know, she's just covering this thing from all bases. Practical. And I particularly like the sentence following mirroring. Go down one after mirroring, one, two, three lines. Projection is also an eminently moral and practical problem. In other words, if one nation sees the devil in another nation, you've got war. So it's a practical issue. How do you help somebody withdraw a projection? How do we understand what integrating a projection is? And so that's the practically important book. But there's another layer, which is projections cause huge amounts of trouble. They destroy marriages. I don't know if you've ever seen, if you want to give yourself a interesting evening, I don't know if the movie is faithful to the play. I've seen the play. I have not seen the movie. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? It's a relationship between a couple, and you soon realize that each person's reality is the projection of the other person. One person will say, well, you're this and this and this, and that person will become that and then beat themselves up for being that. And the other person will say this and this and this and become that. And then until they finally have a child, all in their imagination, and then the marriage blows up. So these sort of projections can be highly destructive, as that play shows. So that's the foreword. Questions, thoughts?
This is a thought, I guess. When I visited Arizona a few years back, I went to visit Casa Mesa. Because you've been there a lot, haven't you? Anyhow, just walking around in this area, and I got in this one space, and it just, you know, I didn't know how to describe it. It's like they were vibrations or mm-hmm. something, and you knew it was something there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. If you like extra reading, not that you don't have enough to do, in volume 8, Jung has an essay called The Foundation of Psychological Foundation of Belief in Spirit. In which he says spirits, like you just described, which people clearly perceive, are projections of complexes. Then, at the very end, he has a PS. After collecting psychological experiences for many people and many countries for 50 years, so this is a postscript written for the second edition, 50 years after the first essay was written, I no longer feel as certain as I did in 1919 when I wrote this sentence. Sentence meaning that there are projections of complexes. To put it bluntly, I doubt whether an exclusively psychological approach can do justice to the phenomenon in question. So, these are some of the problems we come up against. Are these let's call them metaphysical projections, simply projections, or are they perceptions as well? How do you distinguish whether what you might call a collective projection is purely psychological, or are there real spirits dancing around there? I sort of felt my Native American fellow's birds were not speaking to him, so I would have said that's psychological. Vanderpoel's story, to me, contradicts that. So that we have to just keep all these questions open.
I mean, Jung always said, you know, if it happens
see you psychically, that's real.
That is for sure.
I guess it would raise the question of what we consider reality.
That's exactly what it raises, and we will spend a fair amount of time just on that question. How do we know what's real? Basically, we don't. But we can approximate, she's going to say. So you can see how this simple little discussion leads into these huge areas, which to me makes the book interesting. It's very important for me to know this practically, but I think it's interesting for everybody not only to know it practically, but to see how this concept of projection really forces us to reopen questions that we may have thought were settled, and they're really not settled. Let me just go through the whole book, chapter by chapter, give you an outline so you know what's ahead.
So you're on the table of contents?
Well, you could. I noted it in each page over the beginning of the chapter. Chapter 1 is an introduction to what projections are. And then she talks about the five stages of withdrawing projections. And then she ends with a question, sort of where you were, Jane. What's real? How do we know what's real? And she says, that's a question we'll be dealing with the entire book. So that's chapter 1. Very much introduction.
And to go along with what's real, also his definition of what's real is what works.
Yeah, or you might say, epistemologically, is there an objective reality apart from our subjective reality? Certainly, subjectively, it doesn't matter. But objectively is the question. Why does it matter? Well, for example, I may have mentioned... George Bush said he knew from God that we should invade Iraq because they were part of the axis of evil. Well, that's pure projection. We also found, they also found diaries of Al-Qaeda fleeing the military operations in which there were journals where Yahweh appeared to the soldiers, Muhammad appeared to the soldiers telling them the United States was the axis of evil and they should destroy us. So it matters a great deal whether or not we are the axis of evil. So that's where I think reality becomes important, that we compare our perceptions against some idea of reality, knowing ultimately figuring out what's outer real is a real problem. She'll say, for example, the final criterion usually is, if I sit here and I say, there's a monster chasing me from the hallway, you'd all look around and say, Gary, you're crazy. There's no monster there. Well, that would be a definition of reality. There's no monster there. But you get, so that the judgment of the group is the final definition. But you've got somebody like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who says Hitler's evil. He had a whole nation saying, no, Hitler's good. You're the one who's evil. We're going to kill you. So there you can't rely on the judgment of the crowd because the crowd is crazy. So these are the issues that are raised.
So then what works becomes a hard definition, because a marriage where the husband or the wife totally put the other one down and that marriage lasts a long time and the mm-hmm. whole of the community says, what a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But one or the other, one or both of them have never grown, that's mm-hmm. not. So it
Absolutely.
Worked. It worked, but was not.
It was all projection. You also may have heard me say, I remember in my training, a group of us hired a psychiatrist to meet with, discuss our cases from the psychiatric point of view, without having to worry about the institute, getting down our back. And he told us of one of his own cases of a very depressed woman in a mountain village in Switzerland who was severely depressed. And what they were able to do is finally, she lived with her mother who was extremely controlling. And they finally got the young woman able to leave her mother for a weekend every couple of months. And that helped the depression tremendously. The entire village turned against this girl. She was selfish. She was a whore. See how projections work. Just by separating out. So the projected state, everything was fine, except she was miserable. Yeah. So this is the ambiguities you have to deal with. Most of the time, I think we can trust the group mind, but you can't always. So that leaves the question, what's real? Okay, so the first one is just an introduction. What are projections? How do you withdraw? Practically speaking. Second chapter looks at what we have just learned about projection and applies that to theology. For example, I don't think anyone would have trouble saying Zeus and Hermes and Athena were projections of the inner Zeus, the inner Hermes, onto some imaginary figure. So if that's what we project on Zeus and Hermes, and they don't exist, do we project it onto our idea of God? So she raises the question, how does projection force us to reevaluate theology? That's the second chapter. Third chapter, she turns the same argument to science. And her point there is, we think science is objective, but, for example, once we thought causality was the prime dynamic linking events in the mechanical, physical universe. Now we know it's not. Well, that meant we were projecting causality onto the universe. It's something that is not universally true. When we see the principle of uncertainty and the probability movements of the electron, then we realize that scientific theories, just like dogmatic ideas, can be projections. So that's what she talks about in the third chapter. And then in the fourth chapter, going back to the idea of projection and archaic identity, she turns to the collective unconscious as what is projected in the definition of projection as the archaic identity. So in other words, that where Freud would say it's the personal unconscious that's projected, Jung would say it's the collective unconscious that's projected, and she talks about that. So that's the fourth. The fifth chapter is a little more practical. It's if the thing you are projecting is so horrible that it can't be integrated, then what? So that's the chapter on evil demons. And the next chapter looks at inner figures that help the integration of projection. So the one, chapter 5, is where the complex is so horrible you can't integrate it, and the chapter 6 is where the complex helps you with integration. And chapter 7 making it very simple, you could say, is about the projection of the self. And that gets into the question of where is the psyche? Chapter 8 begins talking about what does it mean in the deepest sense to integrate a projection into the ego or into the self. In other words, you can't, not everything can be made a part of your ego, like, you know, the spirits. There are certain things you have, even if they are projections, you will never be in charge of that degree of wisdom, but you can learn to find it in yourself as an unconscious content. So she was talking about, when do you integrate something in the ego, or when do you integrate it into the self? Or integrate it back into the unconscious, you might say. And then the last chapter is, what's the nature of consciousness? That's the mirroring bit. That's the preview of the show. Anyone want to get out now?
We're
going to
be here a while.
Well, we'll see how fast we
go.
It won't be 3 years. No. Okay. It starts off page one, distinguishing Jung's idea of projection from Freud's. And that Jung took the idea from Freud. What distinguishes a projection, that's page one, page two, what distinguishes a projection from an error in judgment? Well, the ability to be corrected. If you have a projection onto somebody, let's say you're married to a creep and you're convinced that person is wonderful, and you try to tell that person, you know, your spouse is a creep, this is why you're miserable, they will defend it with everything in them. That's a projection. And then she mentions, you know, schizophrenics and so on. It's almost impossible sometimes to break the projection. You know, that there is somebody after me. The Martians are going to invade and so on. Now, with Freud at the bottom of page two, I can only assume that what she's saying is correct. I am not that familiar with this detailed discussion of Freud. But Freud doesn't look at projections as a projection of part of your personality. He sees it as a projection of past experience. Now, whether that's entirely true or not, whether he might have changed his mind, I'm not sure. That's her point. And I think basically what they are talking about is, you know, you see somebody in a certain way. Where they would go with it is in the past, to see how you are seeing in the other person an unsolved problem with a parent. So, as she says, it's a memory image for Freud. Lightning? Yahweh has been listening to us. The distinction, and again, I have to assume she's right. It seemed a little too neat to me, but who knows. In any case, the following is true. The way we work with it is, if you are projecting something, you have those qualities, but you don't know it. So we don't take it to the past. We take it to the present. For example, I think, I can't say always, and this is one of the problems, but often when I hear somebody lambasting a spouse, and the spouse changes, gets into therapy, what do you think happens?
The person takes on those qualities that they...
That person will start acting towards me the way they complain the spouse acted toward them. Or they will start acting toward the spouse the way they claimed the spouse was acting toward them. That's a projection. The spouse was a creep, but the individual was a latent creep. And as long as there was a bigger creep along around, that saved them from experiencing their inner creep. But as the spouse became more humane, then they fell into the complex they had been projecting.
So I'm wondering, why does it have, like, scapegoat type thing?
Yeah.
Why does it have to get, I guess it's to be lived out until it's understood? Is that...
Two ways of looking at it. Freudian way is it's too painful. Jung always flips it around, and it's a bit dark in a way, but for Freud, projection is a defense. For Jung, it's a way of becoming conscious. So the reason you could say that one spouse was projecting onto the other was to give the projector a chance to get to know that part of themselves. Now, it sounds bad because I've just described it negatively. It can be positive as well. You can admire somebody. And that admiration, in a way, you could say, keeps you from developing your own talent. Or you could say the admiration is telling you what you're capable of. So you can take it either way. I prefer the latter. That projections are attempts of the psyche to create consciousness. Not a Freudian idea, it's Jung's take on it. Where you see, for me, the thing that lends support to taking projection as a way of becoming conscious, if you begin to pay attention to your projections and watch them over time, it's as if there's a secret intelligence behind them. This is where the self and projection come into the discussion. Projections aren't random. If you look back over a period of a year or 5 years or 10 years, you'll see, if you pay attention to your projections, how what you learned in each instance built on the previous one and was headed somewhere toward your own maturation or the development of your own creativity. So that's kind of thing that got Jung thinking, you know, these things aren't just accidents. They're not just negative things. They work negatively if we don't know how to establish a relationship with them. But there does seem, just like dreams evolve, you know, meaningfully, those of you who do dream work know that. So do projections. So they're valuable bridges to the world and our own development. It's just we have to know how to work with them. Where they become negative is if you stay stuck in them. Well, that's pretty much page 3. The only other thing she mentions is a projection needs a hook. So, you know, if you were married, well, kind of a dumb idea, but let's say if you were married to a saint, you'd have a harder time projecting the devil onto a saint than, say, somebody like myself. If there is no hint of the quality that you're projecting in the person, you can't project. And when we say you're projecting something, that's not to say that the quality you're accusing the other person of doesn't exist. It may very well exist, but the distinguishing feature is it also exists in you. That's what is so rough about dealing with these things. As soon as you tell somebody that's a projection, they'll say, yeah, but he swore at me last night. He's mean. Well, yeah, and so are you. But you, the outer and the inner confusion make sorting it through very difficult. Then she opens the discussion.
Here's my answer. Yeah. I'm sorry, but yeah. This whole hook idea, I feel like I've known people, too, who, like, almost identify with the hook when it's not really in them, but they want to, like, they're martyred, or what is that about?
Well, she talks about that, too. The danger is that we become what is projected onto us.
Oh,
just the reverse. You see that with kids. Mm-hmm. I go as far as to say that what the child becomes is what is projected onto it. It's not what you say, it's not what you do, it's what you project. Another way to put that is, the child will become your expectation. And this is all on the unconscious level. I'm sure you've been out in the world and heard parents talk to the kids, oh no, these are stupid. Well, guess what? That kid is going to grow up to be stupid. That's a projection. Children are not stupid. But the parent stupid sees the parent's stupidity in the child, and the child becomes stupid. And we'll look at a fairy tale that discusses that.
Could we say that ego development then plays a role in whether you fall into that, just taking on projection?
Right. So the goal in this model for parenthood is to get to know your own projections and try to keep them off the child, to listen to who that child is, not what you expect the child to be. And how many people do you know who have, I mean, I was just talking with one of my kids in class who wanted to study the arts. No, the parents demanded he study law. The kid's already had two DUIs. He's pissed as hell. But the parent is projecting a certain professional image onto that guy, which is just not him.
What was that movie, Carpe Diem?
I don't know it.
That's not the name of it.
Was Robin Williams?
She's the date. Yeah.
Oh, no, that's another one.
No, it was Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And the parents projected out of this kid.
The Poet Society.
Yeah, that's a classic example. Yeah, that's classic.
So would a child who grew up with a lot of negative projections would then go out into the world with a huge hook to be the scapegoat for whatever?
To be the scapegoat and to fail. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it becomes a self-perpetuating
cycle. Self-perpetuating, yeah.
I had a question about on page 3, the first full paragraph,
yep.
The last sentence. Because Courtly appears to be diminished or disillusioned because the psychic energy that was invested in the projection is not flown back into the subject that has been cut.
Yeah.
So the projections have an energy of their own, but
right.
When you try to withdraw them, all the energy gets cut off.
Yeah, you know, that the basic unconscious way of living is you relate to the world through your projections, and your energy investment in the world is, you know, either seeing people as wonderful or seeing people as terrible, or maybe both. And when you start to realize people are neither wonderful or terrible, what do you do with all that energy? It flows back into yourself. And then you've got to find the wonderful and terrible parts of yourself and reinvest your energy in a different, more realistic relationship to the world. So usually the withdrawal of projection is followed by depression. Either you got to stop blaming somebody, or you got to stop admiring somebody, and you have to walk the path of developing your own talent.
It sounds so easy and it's so horrendous.
It's hard. The depression is the worst, I think.
Comment on
Boy, you talk about a case of projection. Those little girls are dressed up to be 25-year-old hookers. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's disgusting.
But now the whole culture has become that way because I have friends who have kids who are 6X or whatever size, and they're like, even in small toddler size clothes, you can't find anything that's age appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It's all just ridiculous.
Well, once you get aware of this phenomenon, it's everywhere. As much as I like, you know, this our little Butler basketball team did well, did you ever notice there is always a hero?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the team, mm-hmm. It's a hero. That's pure projection. Why? Why lift one guy up? And if you watch the TV, he's always the guy that's on the they're shooting. It is a horrendous sickness. Because what's the other side of idealizing? A little bit. It's a split.
When you can see the effect on, you know, people who are projected on in the music world or mm-hmm. movie stars
mm-hmm.
and the effect on their lives.
And killing themselves.
Yeah.
Right.
Time
or, you know, self-destructive.
In that sense, a positive projection is just as, or maybe more destructive than a negative one.
Mm-hmm.
Janis Joplin, classic example.
Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And harder to get out of.
Because it feels so good to be in it.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At least the negative projection, you have an impetus to
mm-hmm.
go, but you, mm-hmm. it's hard. Mm-hmm.
We could even say Hitler.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, he couldn't reign without a whole nation projecting on him.
Mm-hmm. Because where I thought, I think, one was the person who was to be the martyr, I was thinking of the drama queen. You know, like, what's going on here? Because they get all kinds of energy from, I guess, being always in this confusion.
And generally in a victim sense. Yeah. I think when you see a drama queen, you can think, you can go back and you'll hear negative parental voices. And it can kill people. I'm sure some suicides are, they simply cannot get out of that early experience of being seen as a loser.
Yeah, that brings a whole new level of understanding of Jesus saying, "I come with the sword."
Absolutely.
Because if you can cut through the
mm-hmm. And it does take a certain amount of aggression, and this is where the ego comes in, and a strong ego to do that. You just say, "I'm not like that, mommy." Yes, you are. You know.
Yeah.
But if you can maintain enough aggression to continue throwing them off, and you have a chance. And I think here part of it is, I think we're born with different degrees of strength, and some kids are more vulnerable than others to it. Some are born feistier than others. But once you're out in the public, you know, just listen, and certainly those of you in corporate life, listen. How the perceptions don't fit the object. Either for good or bad. And you see what an incredible power, which is why she says one of her reasons was it's a moral issue.
Again, the whole thing with performance reviews,
uh-huh.
It forces the manager to, you know, it forces them, you've got to come up with something to say they need to work on,
mm-hmm.
to develop on. It actually forces the projections, I think.
And to the extent you don't have psychological tools, you will probably take the critique as correct. That is what is so dangerous. What we try to do in our work is learn what it is to be projected on and to project So when somebody does project, you can say, well, you know, that's you. It's not me.
So is projection always bound up in some sort of value judgment?
Yes.
And this is where the moral dimension comes in.
Right. Absolutely.
You work on your projections, you're going to have to confront your own value.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll get there. Yeah, definitely.
Which is interesting because I think in our patriarchal society I take that back. But just our feeling function is the hardest one to work on because collectively that's really what's necessary. Right?
That's what's necessary in the final analysis, yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that today. That's an important question.
That's why when you're young, you're so impressionable. And mm-hmm. like when I saw the nuns and the priests so angry, what is going on here? They're supposed to be about, supposedly, they said they were supposed to be about love.
Well, we'll be talking in a minute about, does God project? And I don't know, but certainly the church projects. And what the church projects on those poor people is this ideal of perfection, which they strive to attain, and they're mad as hell that they are. And you can see with, say, the rigidity of the Pope, how strong that is. You know, how many young men have their lives ruined because of that projection. It's an image that is put on people that they strive to achieve, which has nothing to do with who they are.
So it's an answer to Job. Job really was breaking the projection, our projection, or his mankind's projection onto Yahweh.
And I think vice versa, that that image of Yahweh has a negative projection onto us.
Yeah, you never think about that.
I don't. Yeah. It got projected on
us. Yeah, I think I told you I was at talking. I ran into one of the kids in my previous French class who had lost a child to SIDS.
SIDS.
She had just had a child and he had died, and she was devastated. That she's actually Hindu, and she said, "Well, God knows what He's doing. Think about that. Yeah. If that is true, He has just projected murder onto a child." But you see, that awareness doesn't surface, and that's the awareness that Jung is trying to introduce in answer to Job. Somehow, in our view of cosmic forces, we accept a horrendously negative view of ourselves. And we call it goodness. We call it divine guidance. It's sheer murder. Not to say that's all that's going on, but that dimension is going on.
Somewhere in our
view of divinity, we are allowing ourselves to be put in a position of victim.
That's potent.
Well, I killed a child. I didn't say it. I wanted to say, what makes you think he knows what he's doing? I just stayed with her grief. But you can see these crazy assumptions we reach.
We say that self projects as well.
That's what we're going to get into. And believe me, this is going to get complicated. But not only do we project on the unconscious, I know this is going to sound weird, so don't freak out, but apparently the unconscious projects on us as well.
You need to be in a room of mirrors. This is all the way to read this.
Funhouse mirrors.
Yeah, exactly. The ones really dark ones.
This makes me think of the movie Black Swan with all the mirrors.
Yeah, yeah. Everything.
Well, remember when she's pulling the feather out?
Yes.
See, I took that as removing a projection of that horrible mother of hers. And that's exactly what goes on in eating disorders. That killer mother, with all great love and tenderness, is destroying the child. Yeah. And, all of these things we will be touching on in much greater depth as we go along. What she gets into on page 4 is what we will be talking about. What is real? Normally, she says on page 4, the judgment of the group defines what is a projection and what is not. So, you know, as I said, if I see a monster, you all say there's no monster, then by definition, I'm crazy. But, as she also says, what about Hitler? When everyone idealized him, and the few who saw the truthfulness of him were executed. You can't always trust the judgment of the group. And that's what she gets to at the very bottom of that page. Therefore, the judgment of a community or of a society cannot always prevent the projection process. So on page 5, she tries to say, is there no way for us to tell what is reality and what's projection? And she refers to this man whom I don't know, W.M. Pfeiffer, who looked at apparently many cultures' definition of pathology and found two qualities that were universally ascribed to craziness. And that's what she mentions about two-thirds of the way down the last paragraph on page 5. Ego alienation, even that I think is suspect. But the next one, behavior that accords only with one's own laws. And then a little farther down, the trivial, the nonsensical, and deviation from traditional context are the characteristic features of the pathological.
But Gary, like when you use the example of Dietrich Bonhoeffer,
right?
He
yes.
went with his own law of Hitler is evil and evil needs to be killed, therefore it is morally right for me as a theologian to be in a place
right.
to kill him.
Right.
So that would be considered
yeah.
crazy under this definition.
Absolutely. I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. This is not adequate. Unless we say trivial, nonsensical deviation from the traditional context. I agree, this isn't going to be adequate, but maybe she gets closer to it. In other words, the traditional context would be the Christian religion, that he was operating out of a traditional context. And here I think you can see one of the functions of tradition is to support sanity, to give a set of values of that indicate sanity.
And also, if you take Dietrich Bonhoeffer out of the German culture into the world culture, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden he actually is in alignment with mm-hmm. the way, you know, the larger society actually saw Hitler. So, you know, it just depends, I think, on you have to pull your view back far enough to try to get a sense of what the actual context really is.
Or the historical context.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would call this a working possible definition. There are She returns to the question on page 6. This might be a little more satisfying. First thing she does is point out that the existential school of psychology, we don't really have much of that over here. It's more a European thing. It's based on Martin Heidegger and Sartre and so on. But we do have it in postmodern philosophy that everything is an interpretation. Anything that you say is a subjective statement. There is no objective truth. That is a current philosophical point of view called postmodernism. Well, it certainly sounds like it solves the problem. But she's saying it doesn't, because where she's coming from is there is such a thing as reality. Two things, I think, for me, work. One is what she's saying. If your judgment is in error, your dreams will react. Now, the postmodernist would say to me, well, but that is still an interpretation. I think where we can finally end up is if you are continually in error of your judgments. In other words, if you're continually projecting, if your view of reality is wrong, realizing if I say that in a philosophy class that they'd probably get shot, your body will go berserk. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do. So this existential view, the postmodern view, eliminates the body. It's very tragic, I've seen at least two people with a very strong drive to grow, leave analysis and die. So that's why something in me agrees with her, that why we have to be very generous in accepting multiple interpretations, ultimately everything is not an interpretation. There is something going on, and you see that when the body goes berserk. She doesn't mention that. She says her point of refuge would be the compensatory function of dreams. And that works for me as well, but it's hard to convince. But basically, as she says, if somebody is wedded to the idea, my point of view is just as relevant as your point of view, and she says there at the end of that full paragraph on page 6 at the beginning, the one says it is so, the other it is not so, and with this discussion comes to an end. And she then mentions Jung saying the same thing, the third line in the quote, there is no scientific test that would prove the discrepancy between perception and reality. So practically speaking, I think that's what we have to adopt. Particularly if you're talking to very difficult people, there's no point in saying, I'm right, you're wrong. You'll get nowhere. You got to say, well, this is how I see it, this is how you see it, and I guess this is where the relationship ends. And then wait. Let's take a stretch.